This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to This Week in Wrestling, Indies and International. And hey, we're going to be looking at both today. I'm Pete, and of course I'm joined by Tim. Tim, how's it going, man?
Oh, it's going good. Had a long week, lots of wrestling. Getting out there, doing a bunch of other projects. I have another podcast that came out interviewing Johnny P. and Jeremy Bryant.
I loved it, man. People, you guys need to listen to this one. This is really fascinating stuff about going about these guys traveling to the CWF Battlecade show in particular, and talking about their experiences going to there. And I thought it was a really fun listen, and it was just really interesting with a lot of fun little tidbits and details and just neat little stories. And I can't put over the show enough. It just breezed by. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it really did. I actually, for once, went back and listened to it, and it was super quick listen. It's completely spoiler-free, so we're going to be covering the actual Battlecade TV as it comes out on YouTube, but if you want to hear what happened outside the ring, what happened around the ring, what happened before anything even was going on in the ring, that's the show to go check out. So yeah, that's been really it for me. Pete, how about you?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Just recorded NWA On Demand this weekend with Johnny, and so now ready to go here. Gearing up next week, I have Wrestle Circus, and then I'm waiting because we have ACW is putting on a show. It's their WrestleMania show of the year. The only thing I'm waiting for is a weather report, because it's outside, and like the last couple of days in Texas has been like 30 degrees, and I after watching the FIP show and it was like 40 degrees in Florida, I have no desire to be out in the middle of the night freezing my balls off. I did it one time at one of those shows, and it's just miserable when you're just freezing the whole entire time, and it's just way too cold. I don't feel like having to wear a luchador mask to stay warm at their show. So I'm going to wait for a weather report and do walk-up business that day. If it's nice out, I'll go. But, you know, it's just so hard when the show starts at 6 and it runs till like 11 o'clock at night, and it's just cold. I mean, it's just not – I love wrestling, but not enough to catch pneumonia in, really. But, hey – this week, we review Ring of Honor TV, but they had a year-in-review show, so we decided not to watch it. But, man, so that leads us right off to week one on the YouTube. They have 3 weeks of their Battlecade show, and holy moly, what an opening first week this was. Or, you know, we'll call it first week. It's technically one show, a super show. But, man, this one was really fun. It had a lot of interesting things, a lot of action, good angles, good presentation. I really can't put over the part one enough. What about you, man?
Yeah, no, the part one is a lot of fun, and two big tag matches with obviously lots of storyline stuff going on that I don't know if you could have tag matches that felt more different. They did such a great job of having totally different style tag matches. Hot opener, obviously. Lots of different stuff. Cool, really good way to start out the show. I couldn't imagine being in the building for all this, just how much fun it must have been.
Yeah, I'm with you. Let's get right into the brass tacks of things. And it opens up right off the bat with Dirty Daddy versus Kane Justice. Kane is a guy both of us like, because he's a young kid. Looks like he has a lot of potential, just straight out of the CWF Mid-Atlantic Dojo. He's a guy who, first week I saw him, like, man, he has something to him, because he has like that, he had a connection to the crowd. He had good heel mannerisms right off the bat, and you could see, man, he has a big future here in CWF. I mean, and then I know you're right on point with me. I think you came to that conclusion 2 minutes after I did. Am I right? I mean, we were all in on the kid right off the bat, pretty much.
Yep, pretty much instantly. I mean, such a good promo, young kid, and that's, you know, the promo is the hard part of it, but then, as you said, he's playing the game, and he's playing it well. From what I've heard, he, you know, got his training going, and he didn't, I think maybe the commentary mentioned it, or maybe it wasn't, but I had heard somewhere that he was wrestling training, and he was getting kind of antsy, so he decided to go chain jiu-jitsu as well, to have something so he could, you know, have in his back pocket, keep him busy, and add that to his game in ring, and it's really done well for him, because I don't think that there's anybody else in CWF that's really bringing that jiu-jitsu game. I mean, Trevor has that technical, but he's doing more of the World of Sport joint manipulation stuff in CWF. So you got, he's the only jiu-jitsu guy. He stands out huge. I mean, he comes out here in this match, great crowd reaction. And on top of everything, he's working the marks on Twitter, which is huge too. I mean, he responded to our podcast. And then I've seen him just snapping back and forth with all the different fans on Twitter, including good friend Johnny Filipapovich, or it's such a rough
last
thing to
say. Johnny P.
Johnny P.
He has a moniker. He's a gimmick too, man.
Yeah, Johnny P. But Kane Justice is all over Johnny P. on Twitter also. So it's just, the kid just knows how to work, and he's really showing it off pretty much right out the gate. He's hit the ground running at this point. And I mean, with so many people pushing CWF right now as being such a great company, and then he's opening the biggest show of the year for them and winning a title, I mean, he's poised to really be a breakout star, I think, in 2017. You're probably not going to see him headlining Evolve or AAW shows by the end of the year, but I guarantee we'll start seeing him getting picked up in other places by the end of the year.
I agree. The kid has a huge upside. Yeah, I mean, and him and Dirty Daddy, I mean, they just had a really fun match, and they connected with the crowd, which is the most important thing. And I liked the ad of him bringing his sensei to the match with him. I think this is really the first time he really went all out with the, well, I think they call it a gi, and is it jiu-jitsu, is it a gi, or
yeah.
You know? Okay, and he went all full bore, you know. He went with the no shoes, taped up with the ankle tape and stuff, and it really gave his character a wrinkle. You know, not only is he a little smart ass little jerk, he's also a bad mofo. And I thought this was just tremendous. And right, I mean, he's getting heel. He walks out, and you see Johnny P just booing his ass right off the bat. Good for him. Way to be a real fan, Johnny. And then Papa Hale's there booing him too. Dirty Daddy comes out, and we get a Papa Hale sighting of him dancing. I love you, Papa. Thank God you don't have to go to dancing as a way to pay the bills. But man, I just loved it. The crowd is hot. The talent had an extra step. This building is packed to the brims. Kane Justice all MMA geared up. I thought my favorite spot in the match was that apron spot. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, God, I'm trying to remember. It was not like a bulldog, but like,
almost like a reverse STO almost.
Yeah, that's what it was. And it was onto the apron.
Yeah, it was sick. I liked Justice after the arm. I love, Justice is so good at working the body part, and I thought it gives his gimmick more credentials and stuff. Love how he's setting up the twist ending here. And Dirty Daddy is a really good baby face, fighting for underneath, trying to escape, you know, doing everything he can, but Kane Justice is just too much. And a great little story. I think we're going to see some more of this. I gave it 3 stars. Where do you see Kane Justice feud going maybe here? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it depends on how I don't necessarily know exactly how the Rising Generation League title wins, because I know that there's certain rules about who he can defend against. But I mean, I honestly don't even know if I necessarily see him holding that belt for very long, because it is the undercard first year in student belt. And so I could see him dropping that title back. I mean, they're kind of playing up the Ethan Alexander Sharp thing, that he wants to get the belt when he can. I don't know if he's still even eligible at this point. I think he's not. But I could have seen him getting the
belt. They made it sound like it was his last chance against the Dirty Daddy on TV a few weeks back.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure if they said that it was for sure at that point he was no longer eligible or if he was getting too close to the wire. Either way, I mean, I would honestly in some ways love to see him pull the Andre and he sells the title to Sharp anyways. And then, you know, they may strip it from him and hold it up or whatever, but then you go with Kane Justice being the real ass kicker for Ethan Alexander Sharp until he gets sick of his shit, and then he just beats his ass and continues going down the line being a tough guy. I could see something like that working to get the belt off of him without him actually having to lose it, and then he could move on. And I could even see him feuding with Chet Sterling coming down the line for the Ultra J title, just because he probably still fits the lightweight role, but with his jiu-jitsu background and working the more grounded technical style, it's almost like that Doug Williams doing the I work technical style in the X Division thing. I think he could pull something like that off in the Super J that would be pretty great for especially for his character. So I mean, I feel like there's a lot of places.
The most important thing to me though is not to don't lose the character, because that's what I think that makes him stand out, is his sneaky cowardice in a way. Or and I mean, he's still an old school chicken shit heel at heart, but he has the jiu-jitsu background. So I just don't want I don't want him to get into the too tough guy mode. I like him too much as that chicken shit I was gonna say motherfucker, but that's just just that chicken shit role, which he's so good at, and he's chicken shit, but he's smarmy too, where you just. He has that where you just want to see a face slap him upside the head. So I don't want him to get too big headed yet. He needs to keep it. I like to keep his character where it's going, because I really like that direction, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's why I think even, as I said, something like that could work, because even just as Doug Williams did it when he was doing the I'm the technical guy in the Flyers and I don't flip and fly, he was obviously cheating the whole way through. So he's sitting there talking about how he does it. I do it the technical way and I do it the real way. But he's also still cheating and taking nasty advantages and shortcuts, which is, you know, I think that's something that Kane Justice could pull off pretty well in the junior division as you start to build him up, because I think that's really the only place for him that for upward mobility wise right now would be in the juniors, because I don't think he's ready to be in the top mix in the heavyweight within the next year, but I think he could definitely do something in the junior heavyweight scene.
Yeah, he needs to, all he needs to do is get some more time in the ring, you know, because I mean, yeah, this is a really strong match. It was 6 minutes or so though. We just need to, you know, he just needs more time, you know. Let's see what you do in a 12-minute match, you know. Will he be able to fill the time, make it interesting, keep it going in 12 minutes? Because yeah, we just gotta, the sky's the limit for the kid. He just needs to he just needs more time in the ring and more seasoning. He seems like he has the basics, and he has and that's, again, the most important thing I think he has going for him. He has that character down, which is a lot harder to teach, is having a character down who interacts with the crowd. Because, I mean, we've seen a lot of talented people are out there who just have no idea how to connect to a crowd, but this kid does, and that's what we're just raving about Kane connecting to the crowd. I mean, obviously, Dirty Daddy, he knows how to connect to the crowd incredibly awesome, too. So it's pretty neat to have these guys go out and just tear it up in the opening match and set the tone for, hey, this is going to be a kick-ass show, follow us, and that's what they did. What do you think overall of the match?
Yeah, I thought overall the match, I mean, the crowd was super hot, and it just goes to show when you got that good heel and that over babyface that you can, doesn't matter if it's the opener, first year in students. I mean, these guys got great heat for the whole match. The work was solid, but you know, it never went over the top. I mean, the apron spot was the big spot. That twist ending, I think, is such a phenomenal finishing move, and everything else was basic kick punch. You know, I mean, they didn't have to do much to get the crowd just going crazy.
And like you're saying about that spot, that's the other thing that was so good, is like, you know, they did basic spots. They did little spins on basic stuff. But they built a big move that set up the whole entire rest of the story of the match. And because they laid it out how they laid it and brought you to that spot, bam, it was so well done and well executed. And made the spot get over, because you're not doing it five times in a row, like you know, we'll get into it some later on. It's into the like New Japan, for example, and some of the wrestlers sometimes are not just New Japan. I mean, this is a trait of the 2000s where in wrestling excess is means better, and sometimes it doesn't. And I felt here they laid out the story, hit the big spot, and made that spot mean something. And that's the other thing, man. It doesn't matter how many flip flops and flies you do, it's what, how you present the spots and make them matter. And I felt they made that spot really work. And of course, and they got over the twist ending, which I thought was very important. Good job from both guys. Next up, we got the Dawsons versus Eaton and Dalton. What do you think?
Yeah, this felt like it flew by, and it was, I mean, another one where it's just presenting the Dawsons as a real threat when it comes to the tag team wrestling, which I love, that they are exploiting the rules of tag teams. I mean, a lot of times, when Eaton and Dalton could have equal footing and be two on two, they were, you know, they're tough guys who hit hard and they fight tough, but every time the Dawsons would figure out a way to cut off and use the numbers advantage and get it two on one until they pick up the win. And I just thought a great way to set them up as you know, the next challengers, assume like very obviously the next challengers for the tag team belts, in here. And I just thought, yeah, I mean, the Dawsons are just so good at being, you know, kind of dickish and work, as I said, working the heelish number game, getting the cutoffs and cheating when they can. And I just thought that this was, you know, a great way to bring the crowd a little bit back down after such a hot opener and kind of settle in for the rest of the show.
It was a perfect second match in a way, because it wasn't about the match per se, but it was about getting the Dawsons over for a run at the tag belts. They got him over here, put him over strong. So you'll remember, hey man, the Dawsons got one over strong, and they kicked the crap out of Eaton and Dalton. I mean, it wasn't a squash match by any stretch of the imagination. It was a match that a pair of good talents put over the Dawsons strong, and you remember that the Dawsons got a big win coming out of Battlecade to set up stuff for the future. You know, not everything needs to be in the moment in wrestling. Sometimes things are made to have impact and waves later on in the year, and this is exactly what I felt they did here in this match. And I thought putting it in the second way is like, hey, we're, you know, good, it was good storytelling. And then we got a Brad Attitude promo, and this thing was a piece of genius. And that picture of they're at this real wedding, obviously, and how much money do you want to say Trevor Lee was shit faced drunk at this wedding? Or,
oh yeah,
and I'm sure in real life they love it. It's a kick. They get a laugh about it, but I think it's a great angle. I don't mind you. I've been at plenty of weddings where there's some guy's been shit faced drunk and he's doing this or he's doing belly flops on the dance floor or what have you. And yeah, and he, you know, it's not a big deal, but you know, there is like that where somebody could be really find it offensive, and seeing that everyone else is dressed up in nice suits and he shows up in a fanny pack and eventually has his shirt off. I thought it was a great piece of business, and I always like how the heel can justify his heelness, and I really like this piece of business here. What about you?
Yeah, no, and not just, I don't just know that guy at weddings. I've been that guy at weddings, so I totally.
So have I, yeah.
So I totally get it, and I just, it's great, because, yeah, it's like, come on, man, he's just trying to have fun, but also, it's his wedding, so you're kind of being a dick, dude.
And when I said belly flop guy, I was that belly flop. I used an example of me being drunk at a wedding. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, no, it's just great because it brings that realism and the believability, and you know, these guys have so much history together, and he does. He has a legitimate reason to be pissed off at Trevor. I mean, more than just, you know, what he's been saying out in public, which is that he got that big break and got turned back, and now Trevor thinks that he's the hot thing coming out of CWF and Mid-Atlantic, when people are forgetting that Brad Attitude was the original, you know, breakout star from CWF Mid-Atlantic, and they can't forget, you know, just how good he is and all. But then he's also got some personal stuff, which makes it even deeper. It's like, oh yeah, you know, it's not just a professional thing. It's not just a, the fans like you more. It's a, you know, you're also always been kind of a dick. And I thought that was great, and I just loved it.
Yeah, I'm with you, man. I thought it was just a great piece of work there. And then we go in and we get Eric Andrews versus Smith Garrett. And we get this great angle where Osiris attacks Garrett pre-match and just beats the crap out of Garrett, where like they kind of play up that Garrett's been concussed in a way. And he's hurt his neck. And I just love the whole story of the match. Of everything was super logical. You have Andrews just focusing on the neck after the angle, and then he goes over. And now you have, it sets up a two-way where Garrett still feels like he deserves a shot at the TV title, so he still has revenge on Andrews' part. And then he's setting up a, and then we have the Osiris attacks him, so that's just going to be his blood feud, you know? I mean, so it sets up angles on two fronts. Wherever they want to take it, they can take it. But obviously, they're going to take it in the Osiris Garrett direction right off the bat. Good piece of business. And, you know, we took the crowd down with the match two. And then we hit him with a hot, and then he, you know, we take a breather and then bam, uppercut, a hot angle. And then we get a really good, fun match that pays off on the angle. Just good booking here. What did you think?
Yeah, and another one where it didn't feel like we got cheated out of a big match on the big show, but you still kept Garrett protected because he got jumped pre-hand and he comes out valiantly trying to fight back even though he's concussed and has that bad neck that they're always going after. Eric Andrews is just such a fucking scuzzball that he'll take every cheap shot and every cheap advantage you can get. I mean, he was even asking for the count out before the match really was able to start. He doesn't care. He'll just take any cheap fucking bullshit victory he can get. So another just great, like, sticking to the character that he always does. You know, but he's also impressive and can hit that big move at the end when Smith Garrett is just so messed up he can't peel off. I think he's going for a German suplex or something, and he just can't get him up because he's just too messed up. And Eric Andrews just lights out with the big I think it's the asphalt spike, and it's over. And yeah, I just thought, again, you save a big match, but you still give a big match. You're paying off a huge angle, so the crowd is too into it and too hot and excited for what's going on to really think of it as a screw job and, oh, they're protecting him, and, oh, we didn't get this match. I just thought they did a really good job of giving you just enough, but not giving it all away, even on the big show, which is really impressive because a lot of times people expect or want or think that what you have to do on the big show is give everything, and you don't have to give everything just because it's the big show. You gotta, you know, they run this show every week. So yep. They are, you know, it's every 2 weeks they run in the same building, but they gotta keep running. They gotta, you know, there's gotta be a next show, so you can't necessarily give everything away. And you do have a really hot, big blood feud to go with now with Osiris and Garrett. And then, you know, you can get Garrett away from Eric Andrews without him getting a real clean beat or defeat. And he can go back to it later after, and it'll be fresh again. So yeah, I just thought great angle, great way to disguise an angle as a match to get the most out of it. So you don't feel let down at the end of it. And yeah, just phenomenal booking.
Yeah. You know, and then you also think, you got to think about it. CWF Mid-Atlantic is more like a territory than it is an indie, if you ask me. And a lot of people use that term, well, the indies are the territories of now. And I go, in a way, but CWF Mid-Atlantic is a true territory where they're using the same guys and they're just weaving storytelling in and out, where a lot of indies, you know, sometimes the same guys, a lot of times they're not. You know, I could go to Wrestle Circus. They're rotating different guys in and out each week. Inspire Pro use a lot of the same guys, but then they have different guys and they don't run monthly ever. And I'm sure that's the same for you. This is a true blue territory, a promotion where these guys, they're all about the show. And this is just really good. I mean, again, like, you know, you get Osiris over for the main angle. Eric Andrews is able to, this is all part of his character, the angle paying off on that angle. and Garrett gets an out and keeps the babyface strong, and you get sympathy on the babyface because he can get revenge on the heel that laid him out and the heel who took capitalized on him getting hurt by the other heel. Just really good stuff. That leads us to the Sandwich Squad versus Schlack and O'Hare. What were your thoughts here, man?
Yeah, as I mentioned before we even started, I thought that they did such a good job of, you have two big tag matches that are intertwined storyline-wise, but feel totally different. And this was, yeah, totally different with the storm of entrails working really vicious on top with just nasty heat, where the Dawsons, as I said, come across so much more calculated, and they're rough, you know, they're rough, ready to fight guys, but they're also using cheap tactics, cutoffs, and they're more intellectual, while the Storm of Entrails feel like just assholes, and they're just mean, and they're just going at them with big, you know, big strikes, big what throws they can get on the Sandwich Squad with just how huge they are, and then grinding on the mat when they have to, which is kind of the difference. The Dawsons seem like they're more inclined to work guys over on the mat intentionally, keep the ring cut in half, and Storm of Entrails are more just going right at you, boom, 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 nonstop. Sandwich Squad both do a great job of selling from underneath, even Aaron Biggs, something that he doesn't necessarily do all the time. He sold really well here. And then when they do come back for the big hot finish, and there's just kind of dog and pony show with stuff going on everywhere, and then they hit that the big kind of double squish, and it's over. Yeah. And I think the Sandwich Squad looks super hot as they fight off the Invaders, finally, who've been kind of coming in and out for the past few months, and now it feels like they finally have been sent packing, and then you move forward instantly with the big angle afterwards with the Dawson, or with Coach Demini coming out first, and then the Dawsons coming out and setting up the next big tag match. So I thought that was really interesting, and I think, as I said, they did a great job of this feeling completely different as the other tag match that was just a little bit earlier on the card, so it's always good when you're able to pull something like that off.
What type of star rating do you throw at it?
Probably 2 3/4 to 3 star, I would say.
Okay, yeah, I went 3. Then we talked earlier about big spots, and again, another here big spot was O'Hare does this low level drop kick to set up the heat on Biggs. You know, Biggs is a big man, and hit the drop kick there, and then to work him, and then Biggs sold underneath very good. It's almost like you're shocked that they're able to get so much heat on Biggs because of how big a guy is. You don't think it's possible, but it worked here, and it was very good. And I can't put it over enough. I mean, it was another good Southern tag. I mean, we open up Biggs and Mecca with a shine. They're throwing big chops, and then, you know, O'Hare with that low level drop kick to Biggs sets up the heat. And Big sold and sold and made some comebacks, get cut off, sold. And then we get this super fun finish, man. You can't really ask for much more. 3-star match, really strong tag match. And, you know, they go over strong, and now the Invaders have been dealt with, maybe. And then they come out with a big announcement. And what is that announcement?
Jeez, I don't even remember exactly what it was, but it was a tag match for the Dawsons and the Sandwich Squad, but it's...
on Impact Wrestling.
Yeah, it's going to be on Impact, which I knew that they were saying it wasn't going to be on the next show on CWF, but I forgot that they said it was Impact, which is kind of crazy to think about.
It's some tournament, but it's going to be at CWF Mid-Atlantic... At the Sportatorium, I thought.
Yeah, and then also, was it here that they said that the Hardys are coming for the next show?
Yep.
Yeah, so then they also say that the Hardys are coming in, which is going to be huge, crazy as well. Yeah, that's going to be nuts. So that was one where I was thinking if there was any way I could get there for that show, but it's like, you know, it's in a couple weeks at this point now, and there's just no way.
Yeah, I'll be at Royal Rumble, I'm pretty sure, weekend. But yeah, that's definitely on my agenda. I want to get out there this year. It's on my to-do bucket list. I wonder if they made the Impact deal before the new buyers came in on, and now we're with Jarrett, put Jeff Jarrett back in power as in the advisory capacity. But I mean, bottom line, as long as it goes through for them, that's good for them. Gives them more exposure, right?
Yeah, no, definitely, and it'll be interesting to see how the whole thing goes. But I think it's probably a smart move, not just on their part, but for TNA as well. I mean, CWF's got a lot of buzz, and I think that them showing that they're willing to work with a company like CWF just kind of helps out their image and helps other companies and other workers look at TNA in a more positive way. And, you know, it'll, you know, help bring up the morale for people there interested in signing, and helps, you know, the fans' interest, because the fans are going to go, oh, that's, you know, that's cool of them. What's this CWF thing? Oh, that's interesting. You know what I mean? So I think all in all, it's a pretty smart little deal. So hopefully the new management don't think to cut it off.
Yeah. Man, overall, though, night one, what do you think?
The first night, or the first part of this is phenomenal stuff. The opening was great. I mean, Kane and Dirty Daddy's really over-delivered. Two big angle matches, or two matches that really lead to important booking down the way that still feel satisfying as matches and not just angles. They did a great job there. And then you kind of main event with the tag title match, and the Sandwich Squad have still yet to kind of disappoint in any way. The guys are just so good, and I don't know if they were a makeshift team, but I think I heard that just recently, that they were not necessarily thrown together, but kind of just put together to figure something out, and they've really come out the other end of this looking like a really strong, believable unit. So all good stuff to start out.
Just three more days, buddy, and we get day two, part two. I can't wait, man. I really can. I really wish we could have seen this whole thing like in one sitting. But hey, I'm so glad they all give us the opportunity to watch it on YouTube. This is the best promotion TV show going right now. Definitely the best YouTube channel. I mean, we both voted for best TV show. And if I really had to do it, I'd probably call it the best promotion, because it's so well booked and so entertaining. And this is a great start to their big card, man. But hey, let's move off of CWF Mid-Atlantic, and we're going to go to NXT, which is actually in Melbourne right now, or is in Melbourne. And it opened up, speaking of the Dawsons, with The Revival versus Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli. What did you think of this match?
I thought it was nice. I mean, I hadn't seen the Dawsons in a while. I think I haven't seen them since the last TakeOver, and they haven't when they lost the belts.
Yep.
And so I thought it was nice that they took some time off. I thought it was interesting. Dash Wilder looks a little thicker even still now. It's like the guy is just constantly hitting the gym hard. He's not on TV. He's still, you know, working out, and that's good stuff to see. And I just thought the match itself was, they did a good job with the two really green guys. I get super worried with almost everything that Riddick Moss does after what happened with him and Hideo Itami, but you know, he's got to learn, or theoretically he has to learn.
Doesn't it seem like they trusted Moss a hell of a lot more than they did Sabatelli? Because Sabatelli was hardly ever in the match.
I know, which is interesting, because Sabatelli's not the one with the kind of track record of mistakes. And even in here, I think there was something that looked a little iffy where he almost dropped, I can't remember if it was Dash or Dawson, but it looked like he almost dropped him on his head.
Sabatelli, right?
Yeah.
And there was a mix-up spot, too, at some point. I forget what it was.
There was a few little issues, and there was some stuff that definitely came across a little bit mistimed, and both the Revival guys hit the floor at one point where you could tell that that was not what was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
But they just kind of went out to regroup and put everything back together. And it's really, you know, I mean, this is obviously kind of a house show, and from what I've even heard, it wasn't necessarily meant to be on TV. Or aired as TV, so you know, there is that to it as well, or that part of it as well. So I mean, they did a good job here. I think that there was some stuff that it looked like the Revival were off a step, and you could almost say that it looked like the Revival weren't hitting it, but I think it was because of what they were working with. They were off a step from where they normally are, because they're usually working high caliber talent all the time, and right here they're working the lower guys. But I mean, they still did a good job, and they kept the narrative going in of the match, you know. I mean, and they've got such built-in characters now, and everyone knows exactly what to expect from or expect from them. So when they just kind of follow the basic tag structure, cutoffs, working the guys over, it gets good reactions, and the crowd buys into it instantly because they know what to expect. It's kind of, you know, repetitive, and you know what to expect. You get it. That's what they do. But they do it so well every time that it's always fascinating, and it's always interesting, and it's always fun to watch. So it was a decent match, but obviously it's, you know, it wasn't as good as their series with American Alpha or their series with DIY, because it's Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli.
Yeah, I equate this to a 1989 opening MSG match where it would be like Tully and Arn versus the Young Stallions, where they're not the Rockers, the Young Stallions, but they're, you know, the young baby faces, and you saw they made mistakes, but it was pretty much eye opening because we know Sabatelli's been there for a while now. And Moss was kind of the glue to his team, and I thought he carried 80% of the match. With he was the shine, he was the face in peril. Sabatelli came in, blew a spot. It looked like he threw a couple of nice drop kicks, and like in a recovery motion. But yeah, there was definitely something off with the match. But I felt the Revival did everything they could to make it happen. Then we got the Drifter and Bobby Roode versus Murphy and Ty Dillinger. Blake Murphy, the hometown boy. I thought this was really well done. I wasn't blow away or anything, but I thought Roode is such a great heel. I loved how he teased the lockup with Dillinger, and then with Dillinger, but only to tag out. Really good old school heel work there. I thought the shine, solid shine by the faces. Dillinger's FIP is, I thought he totally carried it for his side. Hot tag by Murphy, whose dive takes out Roode on the floor and leaves Dillinger to take out the Drifter for the pin. I thought it was a really well worked, good psychology. Laid out a good story. But clearly, Dillinger and Roode were the cogs here. But I thought the Drifter was really good in his role, which is not something I've said a lot about the guy. He definitely is a natural heat magnet, and I thought he really did a good job in his role. And Murphy was fine as like a plucky babyface with the big spot, but they didn't really need Murphy to do a whole lot but shine a little. What were your thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, very similar to what you're saying. I think it's another situation where it's very clear that this is a house show setting, because it's give the hits to the crowd as what the hot feud on TV that's not moving forward anymore on TV. But obviously, when the crowd came to this, was still a hot TV angle was between Dillinger and Roode. So they're playing that up a lot. But, you know, that's pretty much been done with for like a week or you theoretically that's done with, and Roode has moved on to the title scene in, you know, current timeline. But in this match, that's what they were showing off. Buddy Murphy is a guy who I honestly feel really bad for. And it just sucks because when he did have that tag team with Wesley Blake and Alexa was with them, I mean, that act just felt as polished and as money of an act as anything going, and just really felt like it needed to be up on the main roster and just, you know, work those three working together. And yeah, it was at a time when... Oh, go ahead.
The only thing I felt they were missing was I felt Blake and Murphy offensively stunk.
Oh, yeah.
They were great at bumping and stooging, and Alexa was a great, you know, mouthpiece for him, but they just stunk offensively. And here Murphy looked pretty good with the big dive, but as heels, you can't be doing that. I mean, they understood heel psychology, but they just needed to learn, I don't want to say basics, but learn to do something more interesting, like at least grab an arm and like the Revival. I mean, look at them. They're not doing anything. They're doing basic arm work and leg work or whatever. They're, you know, attacking a body part. So their psychology is super, super good there. And I felt like Blake and Murphy could have done that same shtick to a degree, but they just, for some reason, it seemed like offensively they just didn't know how to work the heat real well. Let me put it
that way. Yeah, no. And that's it. And they tried to get their heat more off of their character.
Yeah.
And it was less off of their work, which was a big issue. But it was at a time when the tag scene in NXT was the back seat. Yep. And I mean, a lot of why it became the front seat is because of how good the Revival was, is. But I mean, you know, they were just as solid an act as the Revival is now, just without the work. Like, I think, you know, kind of we both can agree with that. I think that they got great heat. They were super polished package. And now, you know,
I'll agree they were a really good place setter for the tag team division.
Right. And I think that they they could have done more with them, I think.
Yeah.
But they broke them up. They send Alexa to the main roster. She's obviously doing great there, which is, you know, I don't want to hate on her in that regard, but it just feels to me like Murphy is now spinning his wheels, and he's a guy who could be doing something and has shown that he can. I mean, here he's obviously slightly better offensively as a babyface, but I think he can definitely get good heat from his character work. I don't know, you know, he needs to work on his in-ring stuff, but it just kind of, yeah, I mean, here he's just here. He's just here to do some dives and pick up the babyface part of the match because the crowd's going to be into him because he's a local boy. And you were right. I mean, Samson looked really good here for his role. Teaming up with Rude was nice, as he just kind of seemed like he kind of sucked up some of Rude's charisma, but not in a way that then made it so the crowd liked him, but just made him feel like a more important guy, which I thought that was really, really good there with them as a team. But yeah, all in all, I mean, the match has had a lot of flash, decent storytelling, decent psychology. Everybody played their parts well, but I mean, it was all about Rude and Dillinger and their feud, which is, you know, the crowd paid to see the hits from TV, and they got it in this match.
Yeah, you know, and if the Revival end up going up soon, I wouldn't mind seeing Blake and Murphy repackaged as a heel team again and give him another shot, and or maybe try him as baby faces, see what he can do. But I don't know if they're going to go. I know they're not going to go that direction since they just broke him up. But I really like their look of them. I felt they had a Midnight Express-esque look in a way, or like a Fabulous One look, where they weren't. They just had a decent look to them, and they understood the basics and knew how to get heat. I just wish they would have learned how to get heat in during their match, as in, you know, working heat segment. You know, they knew how to do it with their character work, but they needed to learn, not even fundamentals, but just match layout could have worked better. And yeah, you're right, just timing. You know, they came in the tag division when, you know, American Alpha wasn't hot yet. They were feuding with Sin Cara and Kalisto, and they were only getting like 7-minute matches, so they really able to get over because they were putting over the Young Dragons and stuff. But I mean, the Lucha Dragons. That leads us to a three-way with Liv Morgan, Billy Kay, and Ember Moon, and I did not care for this match at all. That was kind of it was just there. But I thought Liv took a nasty bump on the apron. I thought it killed her. What were your thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, early on they kind of fucked this match up for me, because you show Ember and Liv somewhat acting like they're gonna, you know, team up against the heel, and then pretty instantly Billy Kay, you know, powders to the floor, and they're kind of going at each other. But then you show Liv fighting off both of them at once, and the dynamic seems wrong to me. Yeah. Having Liv kind of fight off both of them with Ember Moon also being a babyface, that was just didn't work. If you're going to do something like that, I could see Ember Moon being the one, or Billy Kay fighting off both babyfaces, but I don't see why you have Liv Morgan, who's like the smallest girl, and she's beating up a heel and a babyface. Just doesn't work for me in that regard. From there, you get into the match. I mean, it really felt like this match never got going, and it has a lot to do with just Billy Kay is okay, but not great, and I don't feel like she is even good on the character side, which is one of the things that you can always say for all the girls in NXT, is that even the ones who aren't phenomenal in ring always are, like, really good at their character work, and Billy Kay just isn't. And Liv Morgan is kind of the opposite, where her work is fine, but her character, I think, is really good, and Ember Moon is obviously probably the second best worker in NXT right now, or women's worker in NXT right now. I think, unless you count like Mickie James, which I don't think anyone with a brain really would. No. But you know, I'm just saying, like, that's the only girl that could maybe, you know, you could argue. But I think just because of that, they didn't let Ember Moon shine in this match, and Billy Kay's character work is not great. And it just, for me, this just never got going, and it just felt like such a waste to have Ember Moon in here. It could have been a tag, maybe throw another girl, throw the other Aussie girl in there and do the tag. I mean, they're probably doing it everywhere, but fuck it, you know? Yeah. And, or, you know, have Ember Moon be the not even in this match and just have the other two go out. I don't know. Like, I mean, there's so many other things they could have done, and this just felt like a waste to have these girls just in here. And I don't think anybody gets helped out from it either, which is another thing. Like, you could argue that the opening tag, the good thing about putting Tino Sabatelli and Riddick Moss in with the Revival is that these young, the young kind of green guys get a chance to work with the vets on a house show, and that's going to help them get better. But in this match, I don't think... Yeah, and give them some time. But in this match, I don't feel like you gave it any time, really. And nobody in here really is helping anyone get better. I mean, realistically, this match didn't have anything in that regard because it's a three-way with almost no psychology. So, like, that's not going to help you have better matches.
Nope. You know, and it's even weirder is they're on the NXT special coming up. They're booking Asuka versus Liv Morgan versus the two Aussie girls. And it's like, man, not going to have Ember Moon on there in Texas? Or, I mean, her own state. Jeez. Maybe they're afraid she'd get a pop. I don't know. I mean, I don't think she would get a huge Texas pop because, I mean, unless there's going to be a – I mean, I know there's going to be a lot of Texans in there, but I don't know how many Texans were following the indies are going to be there, if that makes any sense.
No, and for the girls, it's even worse because it doesn't – like, the guys, at least, people see you around because that's where you're from because you wrestle there. But the girls, a lot of them, they wrestle most of their matches in Shimmer and Shine or in Japan anyway, so it's not like she was wrestling a bunch in Texas.
Actually, she was.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, she worked Inspire, ACW weekly. I mean, monthly.
Okay.
So, I mean, in Austin anyway. But still, I mean, either way, it just seems weird to have a four-way female. I mean, I can understand doing a tag match, but a four-way singles match, I don't know.
And not having her in there.
Yeah, but hey, this leads us to TM61 versus DIY. What were your thoughts here?
Really, really good stuff. Obviously, DIY bring it every time. I mean, that's what everyone's saying around the loop and what you see. I mean, I think I'm trying to remember what match they had at the LA show, if they even had a match. I think they definitely were in a Dusty Classic match, but I mean, these guys just bring it hard every match that they're in for what everyone's saying, and then you see it here too. Big, big work. But I mean, my only problem with it was just, and it was a weird thing that popped in my head when Chris Hero was on Letters from Kayfabe, and it just felt like just like an idea or a concept that might be real, but who knows, is that when he was on there and they were asking him about like the boys going over matches in the back and the terms and what people use, Chris Hero said that like when they talk about essentially control spots in a match now, they always just call it the heat.
Heat, yeah. There's no
matter what.
Shine or, yeah, they don't use the term shine. They just call it the heat, yeah.
Yeah, and I wonder if, unfortunately, subconsciously, the fact that a lot of workers think in those terms affects the way that they work in the match. Because in here, TM61 were working what should have been just a control segment on Gargano, because realistically they were treated as kind of the baby faces of the match, especially as it progressed. But it seemed like they were working heat on Gargano rather than just working a shine segment, which I found very odd.
Was selling that so hard, yeah.
Yeah, and so it kind of messed with me for the psychology, because then the crowd is super behind TM61 because they're the local guys, and then Gargano and Ciampa kind of get in and are cutting off the ring right after that and double-teaming and doing all that, and I was kind of like, geez, I mean, maybe they're trying to do subtle heel, whatever, but for me, it's like, if you're going to do the subtle heel thing, it should be DIY working subtle heel, and TM61 should be working pretty solidly babyface. Yeah. So I just thought that kind of took me out of the match a little bit, and it was early on, so it hurt the match overall, but the guys work so goddamn hard. And this was the first time that I thought that Nick Miller in NXT has looked really, really good. I mean, some of the stuff he was doing here with the big snap exploding suplexes, the delayed vertical suplex, as he came in and he popped up Shane Thorne into the powerbomb position to hit the two-man or the three-man Tower of Doom spot that just looked amazing. And then he pulls Haste onto, I think it was on Gargano, he pulls Haste onto Gargano for the pin there. And I just thought that Miller looked phenomenal here. And, you know, I always really like Shane Haste. I think he's just a great worker, and I think the way he moves in ring is always really believable, and he's got great charisma. But I thought this was the first time in NXT, and really, even in Noah, I was never a huge fan of Miller as much as I was of Haste. I always thought he was good, but this is the best I thought he looked in NXT, for sure. DIY, as I said, always look great. They're double teams, they're crisp, everything is on point. And Ciampa, when he does sell, it's phenomenal, but his offense just looks aggressive and brutal the whole way through. So I thought these guys really, really brought it, and it just goes to show it's that work ethic that Team DIY bring to every match. I mean, these guys, from what people say, are having four-star matches on every, you know, stop on the tour as they're going around with NXT, and I buy it based on what I've seen from them. I mean, one of the worst matches I've seen from them probably was in PWG, but everything else I've seen from them is phenomenal. So
yeah, these guys are really, really are. They're like the weirdest blowjob babyface tag team because they're both ugly guys, and they are a great blowjob babyface tag team. One of the TM61s, I can't remember which one, throws the lamest looking clotheslines. They almost look like his arm is made of rubber, and they really need to work on that. That's the one thing why part of my, like, TM61 can do a lot of these, oh man, that's an awesome spot, but some of their fundamentals I think just look like garbage, and I think that might be having a, that's why I think they're having a problem connecting, because some of their stuff looks soft, and I think they just need to, I just think they need to tighten up some of their execution and, you know, sometimes keep it simple, stupid. Yeah, it's amazing that they're able to do some of these spots that they do, but then they can't even throw the basic clothesline that looks like that will break a nail, you know? They need to learn that, because, you know what, the basics are kind of where you get your storytelling from. The shock and awe is cool, but if you don't have the basics down, man, it's a problem. And right now I feel like they which is shocking since they've worked Noah. You'd think they'd learn to work a little stiff working over in Japan. But they seem like maybe they're trying to soften it up because they're working in the States so much or working for an offshoot of the WWE. But are you seeing that on some of their clotheslines and stuff?
Yeah, and I think it does in some ways go to what I was talking about with Miller, in that Miller used to be the guy who would bring the physicality and more of the kind of hard-hitting aspect of things. And Haste brings a little bit more of the style and high-flying. And I think that since they've been in NXT, he's been working, you were probably right, working a little bit lighter. Because, I mean, these guys had knockout brawls with, KES interactions that were just crazy. And, I mean, then working in the in the junior tag division in NOAH, they had a lot of, you know, matches that came across really good. But in here, you're totally right. But that's why I said here I thought that Miller looked good, because more of his suplexes, his strikes, and more of his attitude was coming across a little bit more ass kickery here, and more like a badass and stiff. But his striking, I didn't notice any of the clotheslines that you're talking about, but I could totally believe it, because that's what I've been thinking he's been lacking a lot of in NXT.
Okay, fair enough. And then that leads us to the main event of Joe and Nak in a cage. We saw this match in edited form a couple weeks back. Now we got it in unedited form in a way. Again, but at least, hey, this time Joe didn't go after Nak's leg, so we didn't get the opportunity to see Nakamura no-sell it. But overall, but again, it was still kind of just ho-hum cage match. I thought it was a little better than the match they did in Japan, honestly. But that's not saying much. But that's because in Japan, they Nak shit-canned all of Joe's legwork. Here, it was just ho-hum, but Joe wasn't as focused on a body part, so ergo, we didn't get to see Nak shit-can a lot of that. But overall, it was still kind of disappointing. What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to say, I wasn't 100% sure, and then I double-checked it and was like, oh, this is the exact same cage match. I mean, I think the editing was a little bit less, but it's the same cage match we watched a couple weeks back, so I was going to just say, essentially, see my review from 2 weeks ago. It's the same feeling. Yeah. The match was not great. They didn't bring a lot of hatred in the cage that you would hope for. They barely used the cage, and it's really interesting because they've treated the cage like it's Joe's thing in NXT. I mean, he was in the first cage match. He's porting the cage match into this feud as well. And, he's not necessarily a guy who works a great cage match. I mean, not that it's bad, but he just doesn't work a great cage match here. And Nakamura doesn't, I mean, Nakamura's fine, I guess. I'm so sick of, you know, lazy Nakamura, and he's really bringing some of his A-game laziness when it comes to NXT. I mean, the guy is just... He phones it in all on his character work, and you can't blame him because he's super over, but I'd like to see some of this, you know, one of the best wrestlers in the world. I mean, what did he have? One of the best matches in 2016 with Kota Ibushi at the Tokyo Dome, and then that was about it for him for the rest of the year when it came to wrestling. I mean, Jesus.
I like the Sami Zayn match.
Yeah. I know everyone really liked that a lot more than me, but I should probably go back and rewatch it just so I can...
Or just say you're in the minority up front. And
yeah, no, I totally accept
that. It doesn't exist. stuff. But that's just a jab right there. but hey, let's switch out real quick. And I want to talk about the Styles Clash show. I watched it. You know, really, there's nothing there that you need to see. I thought AR Fox was good in his two matches. I hate to say I was disappointed in my Sammy Guevara match. I mean, you watched that one, right?
Yeah.
A little sloppy.
Yes.
I thought by the second half of the match, I thought he'd, they started working a decent match, but I thought it was a little too late. I thought that spot where Xavier does the moonsault block onto Sammy's shoulders and he does the squat drop, I thought that was a really cool spot in the match. I felt if they did a better job of establishing heel and face dynamic, I think it would have worked better. But they had an upward climb with the crowd and the weather and all this stuff. If that was the first time you guys saw Sammy, I go, don't judge him on that performance, because that's probably the worst match I've seen him perform in. And again, it wasn't like the worst match of all time or anything. Just, I thought it was just a little sloppy, but it wasn't like the drizzling shits or anything. But he was the one who was pretty sloppy in the match. What were your thoughts overall on his performance and stuff?
I watched that match and it felt like, yeah, Sammy had a couple little, I mean, they weren't even terrible botches. That was the thing, is because I watched it later, I heard a lot of people talking about it like it was just slop city, a lot of really bad looking stuff. And when I watched it, I'm like, it's a couple kind of misfires on his footing.
Yeah.
And a lot of, it was mostly that. It was mostly like he didn't land flush. He had to catch himself or had to, you know, double back on something because he kind of missed it. And I think that there was another good one where there was a spot where Desmond obviously was supposed to go for something. He missed it, and Sammy just ducked underneath and grabbed the choke and jumped on his back. And I thought he did a good job there, where someone could have hesitated and like he did there, where Sammy missed grabbing Desmond's boot at one point, and then Desmond just puts the boot back up into his hand and looks super fake. But what Sammy did in a similar situation was, rather than just, you know, wait a second and hesitate to fix the spot, he just jumped on his back with the choke. And I was kind of like, I mean, that showed that he has at least that good improvisation skill and the instincts to go like, no, I need to just do something else. But yeah, I mean, there were some sloppy spots, there were some blown spots. The biggest problem to the match to me, though, was that it was just cold. I mean, not just the temperature, but the crowd. The crowd was no heat for the match. And I think that if you had a crowd giving this any reaction, I think that people would have been a lot less harsh on it, which is just kind of unfair for Sammy, that this is his first kind of exposure to the world. And then, yeah, like overall, the style battle show, I thought the booking was weird. And they throw on a 13-way, which is, you know, if you happen to be in the know about what kind of money this Flow Slam deal is giving WWN, then you realize why they're just throwing a bunch of people on a card for a 13-way, because they're not hurting for cash when it comes to shows. But, I mean, Jesus, what the fuck? Like, this show was just the odd booking to give the bye to AR Fox. I mean, to me, coming into this, did you think that there was any chance that the final was going to be Dave Crist versus AR Fox?
No.
Not at all, right? Like, that would be the furthest from the thing that I would book as the final. And then you have Fox being the one to get a bye when Crist is a much better heel. So what I do is I go into this with the heel getting the bye and the baby fit. I don't know. The whole thing was just very weird.
Yeah, it was weirdly booked. But at least we got a classic. Or I thought I give 4.25 stars, which was the Henry versus Freddie Ahai match. I thought that was a great piece of work. I mean, they go 30-minute Broadway. You know, Yehai with those stomps were awesome. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they were, you know, they were selling impacts of moves and building on, making everything matter. The one spots I really didn't care for was the no selling of the suplex spots, but you know, they made a decision. I didn't agree with it. I wish they would have sold it because they did so well selling and putting you know, selling impact of moves and. And they're selling struggle, and I like the escalation in the match. And I've heard some places where, well, I wish the stomps would have led somewhere. And it's like, I mean, I really don't think, and they maybe they could have worked in a spot or two, but I mean, the stomps aren't there to make this make it. Aren't the story? It's how he's breaking down. The wrestler, and those stomps are there to watch him, see us watch him break down Henry and being able to take him to the mat and put on the Koji clutch. So in a way the stomps did build to something, but I think that was a psychology that those were just some small complaints I saw where I think they just didn't understand the psychology of it. But I thought it was built well, and I loved the grappling in this, and I thought Yehi's charisma really showed through. I thought Henry was a game opponent, and I thought this match really made Henry into a player in one night. I thought his promo was pretty terrible, though, that he followed up on. That's just something maybe he needs to be working on, is those promo skills. But, man, I can't complain. I mean, a 4.25-star match. But that was the lifesaver of the show, really.
Yeah, and I think they did a great job here. You protect Yehi. You picked a really, really apt guy who definitely deserved that kind of exposure to the world as the guy who got to be in the Broadway with Yehi, which was smart to do in the first style battle in the first round to set up. Time limit draws are a thing, yeah. Guys, and it's probably not going to be uncommon in this tournament because of the setup of WWN. It's Gabe booking, obviously, so you know the way he likes to do these long kind of matches, and the concept of it. It's a tournament of, you know, the best young wrestlers who are, you know, have a lot of fight and all this, so they're gonna go the 30 minutes. It's gonna happen, and it's gonna happen probably regularly.
They should do calls though, starting right off the bat. I thought that would add a lot more drama to this match, where you're getting time calls 10 minutes out, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you know, 50.
Yeah,
you know.
I would like them to be doing the call times all the time. I think there's almost no promotions that feel comfortable, it seems, doing that in America anymore.
Yeah,
and it sucks because it's something that I think always works in making it feel more like a real sport. So I would like to see that, but you're totally right. But yeah, I thought the match, I mean, talking about the stomps in that way is just goofy. I mean, did anyone complain about the chops? I mean, did people say Ric Flair should use some kind of like chest stretcher as his finish? Because he chops people all match. Fred Yehi's stomps are the same as Ric Flair's chops. I mean, if people don't get that, then they just don't get wrestling. The stomp is really his signature strike. It's not hit like a really necessarily something that needs to be played into huge in the storyline. But I think I love some of the ways that he hits the stomp. I mean, sometimes when he stomps on a guy's ankle at a weird angle, I'm always just like, ah, I cannot believe he did that. Because you expect him to only be going for flush, you know, hand and foot stomps. But sometimes he'll just stomp a guy right on the side of the ankle while his leg is twisted up a weird way. And it always looks great and excruciating. And again, I think that
Or he does variations of the teasing, or he looks like he's going to stomp the hand and then goes to the leg and changes cross-ups. I mean, this is really good work.
Yeah, no. And again, I think that Anthony Henry was the right guy to pick for this spot, in that, I mean, you instantly kind of make him a star in the WWN universe now, at least to people who are paying attention to FIP, which is seemed like most of this crowd that happened to be at the Style Battle show knew FIP well enough to know who Fred Yehi was. But, you know, and then am I wrong that they even said that, you know, this means Henry's coming back for another Style Battle for sure?
Well, Henry did an interview saying he wants a piece of it. And the guy who was interviewing him sounds like a plan type of thing, you know.
Okay. So I'd love to see him come back and avenge this by winning a style battle later on. And you know what I mean? Because that just makes too much sense, honestly. So I just thought that they did a great job here. And it was really the reason to watch this show was for this match.
And it was also interesting because this was the only style that it was done in this grappling way. So it really helped them get over, as opposed to having three matches like this on the same show. Sometimes, like Evolve, you can have three like grappling matches, like with a Thatch or a Gulak match or a Busick match. And this is just three guys I'm throwing out there. I know two of the three don't work for the Rock company anymore, but that's, you know, but here it really got a chance to stand out and breathe. I didn't like how he also presented, like they mentioned how so-and-so's a coach and this is his student, so-and-so's a coach and this is a student. So it almost saying it felt like a lot of the field was the coach and students besides Sammy, Fred, and Anthony. The other four were coach and student, which I thought was a weird way to present it in a way. I would have gone with a different piece of talent to win the first tournament. I mean, of course, and I thought I was booking, I would have booked Sammy, but I easily would have gone. You could have gone with AR Fox right off the bat, or Anthony Henry, or what have you. It felt a little weird going with Christ, but I guess maybe they went with him to get him over strong because they were putting him in part of the heel faction, and he didn't feel Fox needed the win to give him credibility because he already has it. But again, in this next or second show, it's weird to turn Fox heel because he's a natural babyface. And now that's two promotions booking him as a heel when he's a natural face. But, you know, what can he do, right?
I guess nothing, man. I mean, I kind of don't mind the idea of student-teacher, but what I do kind of mind is that the style battle concept was, like, initially on the other the Evolve shows, it was the idea that it was, you know, four guys that were all different styles.
Yeah.
And that was the style battle. Then when I heard this show presented, I thought that what they were saying was that each tournament was going to be one style, which would have been probably kind of bad. Because the one good match on here was the one that was different than everything else.
The other thing was like normal high spot wrestling, and this this is the only one that was like felt different.
Right, and so, but I almost wouldn't have minded if they had done more of a player-coach thing and had, it would be almost impossible to duplicate, but with these guys, you could actually pull it off where you would have, you know, Chris brought him and three students, and Fox brought him and three students, and you did the tournament that was all that way, and then having it That'd come down to the teachers at the end would have been good, but yeah, I get what you're saying, where it's like, you know, four out of the eight are each other's, you know, teacher student, and then the rest are just whoever. It just feel a little weird. So I get where you're coming from on that.
All right, man. Why don't we take a break, and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of the Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your...
And we are back. And This is New Japan Pro Wrestling, Wrestle Kingdom 11. And very long show. I mean, I don't know how you can complain. I thought it was an excellent show. But, you know, it's one thing I always find weird, and everyone has their biases. But I've never seen a bias with New Japan Pro Wrestling where the fans really overrate the undercard. I have no problem with them thinking their main events are the best or whatever. I thought all four of them were good, you know. But I've seen some of the star ratings on some of this undercard stuff, and even for Meltzer, I found it was highly we were on to watch like it felt like we were watching two different shows, and I thought the undercard was solid stuff where it wasn't bad. But watching watching people throw down the star ratings for these things, this undercard was a hell of a show too. Did you feel like a disconnect in seeing a lot of the star ratings out there?
I mean, I don't really check everybody else's star ratings, but I mean, if you're saying that people were putting the undercard in like solid three, like over three star territory for everything, then yeah. Because I think for me, for the undercard, everything was like three star was the limit.
Yeah.
Was like the highest that anything went. So yeah, I don't see how you could talk about this undercard like it was big. But the only talk that I really saw out of anybody about this show, unfortunately, just happened to be the only stuff I saw was about the main event, the IWGP title match. I didn't really see talk about too much else on this show at all.
Yeah, true, because the main event was such a polarizing thing. But I'm pretty forgiving on people having different tastes. I know there's going to be the New Japan fans who are usually going to love any main event that New Japan serves you. So it's almost hard to take some of their criticism. Sometimes it's hard to buy into what they're telling you how great it was, because they always tell you how great it is. And sometimes it is great, but sometimes I don't see the greatness. But a lot of times when I'm seeing they just seem like they way overrate under, and it's because I feel they have a biasness in their promotion. We all have our biases and stuff, but I just always found the rating of the undercard really weird when it comes to some people, where like even Meltzer, I thought way overrated some of this stuff, and we'll talk about it. But it opened up with the Rambo. I didn't think anything. I thought this was, you know, fine for what it was. I thought having Scott Norton out there was neat, and I felt him and Elgin, the fans. I love how the fans still believe in Scott Norton all these years later, that he's like a badass still. I preferred last year having Haku as my big surprise. But it was fun to see Kobayashi out there too. Favorite part of the show of this was Carino's line was, "I look more like Caprice Coleman than Scott Norton." I like that line. I thought it was funny as hell. But overall, this is it was what it was, which is just to get people on the card. What'd you make of the Rumbo?
Yeah, I mean, lots of fun and like just whatever stuff, but also a lot of sloppiness in this match when it comes to production stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of whoever's putting the match together isn't thinking about details. They're doing a lot of the finishes during the entrances of other wrestlers, which just kind of messes with everything because the audio is off because the music is playing, and there's a bunch of problems with that. But I mean, they did a good job of making it after last year's really feeling like a comedy act by the end of it. This one at least felt serious by the end, even if it was coming down to cheeseburger. It felt like Elgin is a badass, big deal. The crowd was definitely into him. So it was a good job making Elgin the focal point of this, but also when they were doing the comedy nostalgia bullshit, you did not see Elgin. You know what I mean? He was gone for the bullshit, which I thought was perfect. So he was the, you know, definite winner. The crowd was definitely into him, but he kept himself serious like an ass kicker the whole way through. So they did a good job there. And Scott Norton stuff was great, but I would have liked a little bit more Norton-Elgin interaction, honestly. But, you know, how much can Norton really do right now, unfortunately?
On the New Year's Dash show, I don't know, did you see any of that?
No, I haven't watched any of it yet.
Yeah, his strikes look freaking terrible. off the bat. Yeah, the aura of him being a badass, like, it, to me, disappeared like a minute in. But that's okay. That's fine because he's not working there regularly. Then we got Tiger Mask W versus Tiger Mask the Dark, which is Kota Ibushi versus ACH. I did not like this match. That was the worst match on the show. Yep. I gave it a star and 3/4. It, I think ACH probably must love this as he's a big anime fan. I'm surprised WWE hasn't done something similar with type of gimmicks like this with their network, and they have they're using having cartoons. I'm surprised they haven't created a gimmick to put a wrestler in based off their cartoons that appeals to kids. But then again, their cartoons are more aimed at adults, so that might be why. I thought we got two nice dives. The mask kills what they can do, but I've seen people and like Dave Meltzer gave I think gave this thing 3 stars. I mean, how? I've seen other people do that online too, and it's like, dude, if you it was like a 5-minute match with a pair of dives and sloppy work. I mean, that's what I meant by overrating the undercard. I mean, this is the prime example. What were your thoughts and what was your star rating here?
If I told anybody on the planet Earth, like at any point before this match happened, that Ibushi and ACH were going to have a match, they would not expect this at all.
Yep.
2 stars. It sucked. The masks ruined everything. One thing really quickly popped into my head. What if Kota Ibushi is doing Tiger Mask W because his body is so shot and he knows he can't deliver at the level that he used to, so he doesn't want to let the New Japan fans down?
Good talking point.
Because in DDT, he's able to do goofy stuff with some flips and things here and there, but realistically in DDT, he's over to the level where he can get away with nostalgia and not being as crazy. Meanwhile, in New Japan, it's not quite the same. And if he, I mean, he was pretty toned down here for Kota Ibushi. He does the, you know, the golden triangle, but that was really it. So I just wonder if part of why he's doing this is
and
because
another reason why he didn't sign with the WWE. I mean, you knew he was offered a contract. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah. So I just think this guy is probably banged up worse than he wants to admit. And he's trying to let himself rest, but kind of still be out there working somewhat to see if he can get back to normal. But yeah, 2 stars. Really disappointing for what you would expect from ACH and Kota Ibushi, but I mean, that's not who wrestled, right? It was Tiger Mask W and Tiger the Dark, so all I guess they're just not very good. Those two workers aren't very good.
All right, and then we had the Young Bucks versus Roppongi Vice. I saw ratings go as high as 4 stars here. I didn't rate it that way, but how do you view it, and what do you give it star rating wise?
Good stuff with the Bucks being dicks early on. They kind of toned down the craziness here, and it was more about their heel work in the beginning.
I like how you say that, where they walk out with their own super kick belts.
Yes, exactly. It's all about being cocky assholes. Rocky looked like a valiant fighter. He's taking off both of them after Trent with the big dive, and he's missing on the floor for a long time. And that's a smart way to do it because the crowd, just everybody in the crowd loves Rocky and the company. You know, he's been there for years. He could speak some Japanese. He's got great callback spots that everybody's into. But, I mean, I think I liked the finish, you know, flash pin out of nowhere. And I think that realistically, this was not like your crazy, wild, bomb-fest Young Bucks match. I mean, this was more like a revival match than a Young Bucks match if you kind of sat down and look at it with them working heat. I mean, obviously it's nowhere near as good as a revival match, but I mean the structure was closer. But I mean, I couldn't go higher. I went 3 stars, and I even think that might have been overrating it slightly. I can't imagine 4 stars. I mean, I enjoyed the storytelling, and I really like Rocky Romero as the underdog, valiant babyface, you know, coming back to battle both guys. So that's what gets it up there for me, is my investment in him. But all in all, I mean, 4 stars just seems ludicrous.
Yeah, I went 2 3/4. The only thing 4 stars about this match was Beretta's insane dive that, you know, that he, no one was there to catch him on. The super kick tag belts are kind of eye rolling. But I guess that's the point. The the near countout trope is just really predictable at this point. I mean, I know it's a New Japan, not just a Young Bucks thing, but these guys just do it constantly where it's just like, okay, we get it. I like the Bucks getting heat leads to the Bucks getting heat miscue leads to the Roppongi Vice comeback. The 450 near fall was a great one. The finish had no one factor, but the finish didn't have a single wow factor at all about it, but it popped the crowd, which I dug, which shows, hey man, you don't have to do super high spots to pop the crowd. You can actually do something interesting, different, and you'll get a reaction from the crowd. And I thought that was interesting here, but yeah, no way this is 4 stars. It was just a tag match that was there.
Well, is that a kind of a major negative comparatively to modern wrestling? Like, almost counterintuitive opposite of what your goal should be in wrestling is that, as you said, they popped the crowd with a novel concept of a roll-up pin.
Yeah.
And instead of some crazy, flashy, death-defying driver or dive or something that's, like, really hard and dangerous.
Yeah.
Is the norm, and the roll-up is the, oh, that's exciting because it's different. Like, shouldn't it be the other way around?
Yep. Especially in New Japan matches, when you think about it. Most teams win with their finisher. So a freaking roll-up is really novel.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like the roll-up and the safe move should be the everyday.
Yeah.
And the big crazy dives and spots should be the wow factor. But, you know, wrestling's changed, right?
Yep. Now, this undercard was my favorite undercard match, which was the, and I still don't think it was an incredible match or anything, which was the three-way never open tag match. We have Takahashi and Paige and Fale versus Yoshihashi, Ospreay, and Jado off the bat. I liked how the first stanza was kind of like the layout and the build to it. I think Takahashi's girls, the gal with the cat ears, I think would be the only one I'd give a 24 for a lap dance. The other ones didn't do anything for me. Ospreay, they did a really good job of making him stand out here. Paige was the glue here for the Bullet Club, and I really want to see Ospreay work Paige now, because I thought they had this weird good chemistry here. And I liked, I thought this was, they set up the heat really nice, but we never got the heat, and it went away. In the segment, they went right back to the shine, and then we end it there, and then we get, Sonata, Evil, and Bushi versus Ricochet, Finlay, and Kojima, and pretty much they get rid of them right off the bat, and we go right into the finish, and, I thought, this was all go, 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 go. So I kind of liked that as a dichotomy of what we saw earlier, where it was more, this is the beginning, and now it felt like we're going right to the finish. So I liked how they were able to connect the three ways together in that aspect. I thought Ricochet looked incredible in this fall. I thought the heels heat segment was really well done. I like the go, go, go aspect part of this because it's going towards the finish. I thought it was a great near fall when we got the miss towards the end. Overall, I thought it was a 3.25-star match. I thought this is a really fun part of the undercard. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed this, but I think
See people not liking it as much as I did because it was, you know, it's sometimes it's hard to rate it because it's so many different players involved and it seems, you know, what wasn't working for me, I'm sorry to cut you off, was I wish they would have introduced everyone all at once and put the next group on the floor. So when it was time for them to come in, they would just come in and not have their ring announcers. So it wouldn't break up the flow of the match as much. That hurt me too. I'm sorry. Go on.
Yeah, no. And that was it. I mean, I liked it, but the kind of breaking up the flow of action for me, kind of hurts the match for me, but I totally get why they did it that way. Actually, did you give a star rating for the whole thing?
Yeah, I give it for the whole thing. I didn't break them up into segments. I gave I gave it 3.25.
Okay. For me, the issue was just that like you break up the stuff. I mean, it was so segmented, and then if I had picked it apart into each segment and rated each one, I may have gone lower and higher. But
yeah,
as a whole thing, I went 2.75 because I just. Ospreay, I love Ospreay a lot in certain spots, but he is kind of another one. He's falling apart. I mean, his stuff in this match, to open it up, when you put him in a trios match like this, he just goes spot foo 100% with no psychology, and that's what he's doing here.
Yeah.
And there used to be almost in everything he did, there was like flashes of transcendent brilliance and how just smooth and amazing he looked, but he's not quite at that level like he used to be anymore. And I get the booking here, and I think that some people looked at it like a waste that you didn't put Ospreay and Ricochet in together, but I think the booking here, they did a really great job. And I don't know that you could have gotten the same tone that they wanted from the story of the match if you had done like something like what you're saying or something that didn't segment the pieces as much, because the opening part was completely different, and then once Ingo Bernabéz got into the match, the tone and the complexion of the match completely shifts. And it's just a totally different thing. And I think if you didn't have that stark transition from one part to the other, I don't think it would have worked as well. Yeah, because once LIJ is in control, it's just all about them working as a team. They're a unit through and through. The Chaos team can't keep up with them at all, and they put them out. And then once the champs do come in, it's like the champion team shows that they're able to work better as a team and as a unit to keep up with them, but they just don't, even they can't kind of fight off how well as a unit LIJ work, especially with their willingness to use underhanded tactics like the mist. And I did like that he hits the mist, goes for the pin and gets the kick out so that Evil can hit his finisher to get a more almost clean victory that he won with his move. And then they get the belts and move on from there. But yeah, for me, it's just too much. And I think, like, maybe if I rated just the second two matches, they would probably both be above 3 stars. But when you mix in the other two matches or the other match part of it, it drops it down a little bit.
Yeah, fair enough. Then we got the American Nightmare, Cody Rhodes versus Juice Robinson. What do you think about this one?
Fine, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I enjoyed the start with Juice being hot and looking to prove himself, and he hits that big belly to belly on the floor and then the cannonball into the rail. And then Cody's all over the leg, like really nice. And I love that he's over the leg and Juice is selling well. And the crowd gets behind him because they've invested in him because he spent a lot of time in Japan as a gaijin, but they know he's in the dojo. So they're behind him and all that. But I kind of wish that Juice didn't talk a bunch of shit early on. If he's then going to be an underdog face in peril, selling an injury. There's just something to that where I kind of like a more pure babyface. If they're going to be like getting the crap kicked out of him for the match, I don't want him cursing and shouting and acting like a dick before he's kind of taking his ass kicking. Cause it kind of runs, I guess, counterintuitive to me to go like, oh yeah, I should feel sorry for him now. And it's kind of like, well, he was talking a lot of shit. So do I really feel sorry for him? Like, not really.
Yeah. Cody looked down there. Yeah. He did kind of come across as like a crappy babyface at points.
Yeah, so Cody looked vicious and he's full of himself and nice, solid work. But, I mean, this is not the match to do on this show. And there was just, like, no way that you're going to do a match like this that really comes across more, like, I would almost say more like a 70s match. I mean, he did great work focusing on the leg and, you know, it was all about the character work from Cody. And he did a good job and it came across heated, but like I said, this is not the show for this match. And I think that this show on just some random indie somewhere would have done this match on some random indie would have done a lot better, but not here. It's not going to do great. So I think it's 2.75 star though. I enjoyed it quite a bit and I liked the narrative and the storyline and everyone. I mean, Cody did really well, but I just thought Juice, I mean, from the beginning, he was good. He's just hot and, you know, pissed off and ready to fire, but then selling underneath and after having been cussing and talking shit just doesn't work for me. But the match itself was pretty okay.
Yeah, I went 2 stars, but I have a different take than you. I I mean, obviously it was interesting because Juice is back in his NXT role trying to get the talent over. I liked Juice catching Cody on the dive for the belly-to-belly. I thought that was an awesome spot. Juice knees buckling. I'm like, cool, okay, that's part of the story. I didn't think Cody went after the leg nearly as much, and I thought it hurt the match a lot. And I thought Cody not working the leg was pretty terrible. He went to it for a bit here and there, but then we go back to punches, and I thought that was terrible. Then they had this weak bump on a double knee spot where they mistimed it. I felt this could have been a compelling match if Cody could have worked a heat segment. I thought Cody's work on top was just terrible. I thought he should have been nasty and been a real prick attacking that knee. And I felt, weirdly as it was, Juice is more of a, some of his body language is more of being a prick than Cody was working the, trying to work the heat segment, and it just didn't work. But I thought Juice, and I thought Juice's selling was weird underneath. I mean, he tried, but then again, Cody didn't do anything to warrant big time selling. So I thought it was just like kind of a mess going on there. Next up, we got Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly for the Ring of Honor title. So Adam Cole goes over, so we know where obviously Kyle's gone. I gave this 2 3/4. I thought the start was really hot. I enjoyed Kyle getting his shoulder worked over. I thought liking O'Reilly using other strikes to avoid the bad arm. I liked that part. Liking O'Reilly zigs, then zags to go after the leg. Really interesting ways to for setups and takedowns. Hated the mirror sequence. It felt a little forced on the strikes. But I thought O'Reilly's arm selling was fantastic here. But they're wrestling in a vacuum or in a fishbowl where no one gave a shit what they were doing. And so I only gave it 2 3/4. I might have liked it more if the crowd gave a shit about it. I'm a guy who the crowd heat matters, and the crowd just didn't give a shit about these guys. And you know what? The fact that Ring of Honor, we talked about this a few weeks back, I mean, gave O'Reilly this big win just to take it away here just sucked and wasted a year of booking. And now they're back at what the hell we're going to do now, especially come March or whatever, or May or whatever Cole's coming up. I mean, better hurry up and get somebody ready. I mean, I'm going to hate to say it. I thought they shouldn't do it, but now it feels like they're forced to go with Dalton on top. What were your thoughts here? And
It seems that way. I mean, mirror spots between these two are never going to make sense because they've never been positioned as really equals in any way. They've been treated, or they've been always positioned as opposites more than equals. And like, I guess,
but it was mirror spots when they went for the double kicks or in the double, saying there, which makes sense in a way that they, at least it's because they were tag partners. So I can buy into the fact that they're both thinking of the same move at the same time. But I just felt it came across forced and not organic.
No, and I agree with you. I think that they were a tag team of congruent shapes, not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not ones that like kind of show, they kind of fit into each other's weaknesses rather than complementing each other.
They weren't the rockers or whatever, you know?
Yeah, so that stuff just doesn't work for them. But I did, again, I liked the open, as you said, super hot. I loved when Cole hits the chair on the shoulder and just tells Todd Sinclair, what are you going to do about it? I can do whatever I want. I love Adam or Cole with the bad mouth, and all it does is fire O'Reilly up, which I thought was great. He's taking over. He's on the leg and the focus on the body part. And I thought commentary did a great job here of putting over Kyle O'Reilly's focus on the body part as being kind of valiant and old school wrestling, and this is how you do it. But then Cole doing the same thing is opportunistic, and he's working over the bad shoulder. And, you know, it's just such a good job because not only did commentary pick it up, but that was the storytelling of the match, which I thought was very interesting. interesting that you can show that difference. You can show, okay, focusing on an arm for one guy is valiant and good. Focusing on, you know, an area for the other guy is cheap and unfair. And I just think that's something I really think you can only pull off in pro wrestling, honestly, because it's like, where else do they not, like, really 100% accept, like, in a sport that turnabout is fair play? You know what I mean? Most of the time, that's just, it's the rules and you just do it. But they do a great job with that here. Kyle, I mean, God, from the best of the Super Juniors, when I complained about a lot of his offensive sequences coming across as going along with drills, in this match, he does such an amazing job as he hits that brain buster and then takes forever to transition into the pin and then slowly into the cross arm breaker from the kick out on the pin. And it was just, he's developed. I mean, he's really put it together where this match was feeling like he's getting worn down. He's so messed up. He can't just go into his spots and do that Davey Richards-esque kind of spot thing. He's selling in between moves and making a big deal out of it. So I really enjoyed that. Cole's looking for super kick, but misses it. And he's just almost so pissed off that he doesn't get the first super kick that he does three to Kyle, telling him to go down. And when he finally does go down, he hits him again. And then the final shot and the face on that Cole makes, I thought was great. And I think that a lot of people saying it was over the top for something. I mean, yeah, it's over the top because of this, how quick this match was. I think it did a great job of showing that Cole was not only in the beginning, he was super cocky, but and arrogant, you know, but at this point he realized, like, oh fuck, I can't believe I pulled this off. And I can't believe I pulled it off so fast, because he knows that he can barely beat Kyle, and he knows how much it takes for him to beat Kyle. So, like, the idea that he was super shocked here makes a lot of sense, and I thought it was really good to show that kind of weakness in his character. Like, sure, he acted really cocky and confident, but that's all play, and deep down, he knows what it takes for him to be able to put away Kyle, so he was shocked that he was able to pull this off so well. So I thought that was great. I also think that the kind of ubiquitous pick-apart that I heard from people saying that this felt like you just lopped off the first 10 minutes of an epic 20-minute ROH title match and just gave the closing 10 minutes was really hollow, because this did feel like they built well. It was epic match from start to end. It didn't feel like, oh, they just started going into the final 10 minutes of a hot match. No, it felt like they had an entire hot match just condensed down. I gave this 3.5. For me, I get what you're saying, that there was not a lot of crowd reaction, but I'm bought into the storyline. I love these guys so much, and the work was there, so that I think that, you know, that's, you know, where this match was at. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's fair enough, and I'm not gonna chide you on that one. I'll give you that one. Then we go into the multi-tag match for the titles, which was Yano and Ishii versus Hanma and Makabe versus the Guerrillas of Destiny. What were your thoughts? What about what do you think about this one?
I mean, obviously the story of this match is the Tangaloa's cussing. That was just the commentators were losing it for, as he's just shouting, "I fucking hate you!" And it was all mostly all directed at Hanma, which is really interesting. It just makes you wonder if maybe Hanma's been stiffing him a little bit more than we all realize, because he's just cussing up a storm directed almost entirely at Hanma. I thought it was interesting to start as Yano gets jumped, and then, you know, the Chaos team of Yano and Ishii are pretty much non-factors for big long chunks of this match. I thought Guerrillas of Destiny came across looking really good, a lot better than they ever did before. Tangaloa is now not the most awkward wooden thing in the world like he used to be when he first started in New Japan. He's actually coming across competent, and starting to see more of Tama Tonga, what used to shine before this tag team started and what made him look like he was a guy that could break out. So I'm excited for them in that regard. I thought that the Guerrillas of Destiny looked good in control, as they're really just taking it to Hanma. And even when Makabe comes in to try to, you know, set them up, he can only take over for a few moments. When Ishii finally does come back in, he gets tagged back in, and it was really just kind of a fucking weird ending where it just made me kind of question the rules completely, as Yano blind tags himself in, and somehow because he's tagged in, now Ishii can just come in too. I was like, is it tornado tag rule?
Yeah,
I don't know what the fuck was going on. Double low blow, they get the pins, and, you know, Yano and Ishii are going away with the titles, which makes sense for story and to pop the crowd for the night. But I mean, realistically, the real stars of this match were the Guerrillas of Destiny. They looked good throughout. And Hanma taking an ass kicking was the other, like, the only people who really mattered in this match. Everybody else was just kind of either missing on the floor or what they did was just whatever, like Makabe. I mean, Makabe was almost a bigger non-factor in this match than Yano, honestly, because even when he did come in, it was just for boring nothing, who cares about. Gave us 2 3/4 star, but I am interested to see where the story goes from here.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually really interested because the Gorillas of Destiny are working Wrestle Circus next week against KES. So I'm actually thinking they might be able to have a damn good match if they work hard. I'm just curious on how the Gorillas of Destiny are going to work on an indie. I too gave this 2 3/4. I think triangle tag matches are about the hardest thing to pull off. Three ways are hard, but six people, and when none of these teams are real high spot oriented, usually that's really where they're better at when they're doing triangle with a bunch of high spot teams like the junior teams like the Bucks and Red Dragon and Roppongi Vice or something, because they're able to they're really good at it and they have a lot of chemistry together. But overall, I thought they did a good enough job here. But it seemed like a collection of moments and a lot of high impact moves. Had a very video game esque, you know, like when you're playing a wrestling video game. Very rarely are you grabbing a headlock or a chin lock, your body slam, clothesline, and that's what it felt like here. Very video gamey. But I thought it was fun. 2 3/4. And that's the undercard, folks. I feel both of us rated it much, much more fairly than what I've read about online from a lot of people. I mean, I guess I'm seeing pretty catty on it. I like New Japan Pro Wrestling, but I'm just shocked at how overrated some of it is sometimes, where people just overrate a lot of it. And it's one thing to overrate the main events. But I always find it weird that you're so invested that you're overrating the undercard. But, you know, what can I do? Why don't we take a break here, and we'll be right back.
PWO PTBN feed has changed its name. Now it will be known simply as Pro Wrestling Only. So it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
And we are back, and we're going to finish up Wrestle Kingdom, and we open up the main event run of the Big Four, which is opening up with Kushida versus Takahashi. And this was the match I like. I thought it was going to be my favorite match. It wasn't, but it was still a good match. I gave it 4 stars. I liked the big dive right at the bat. I'm not a big fan of. I like the dives to be built to. And so I'm thinking right here, I'm thinking Liger and Suzuki, the great Sasuke, and because they used to do this a lot at the Dome shows. Or a couple times they worked it. I like Kushida. He's on the arm. And we get this power bomb off the apron by Takahashi. It looks like it kills Kushida. I think Takahashi has this great swagger that gets him heel heat. I thought the crowd was totally into the match. They had this blown spot that was like almost near crippling, where I thought someone might have broken neck on. I thought the cross arm bar on the floor was fucking awesome. I thought they built really well, and I thought there was a lot of great spots and moments here. I heard some places thought the blown spots helped the match. It did it for me. But overall, I thought it was 4 stars, and I thought it was smart to give the belt to Takahashi and to establish him in the division. And I thought this was a really, for people to say that the juniors can't get heat in the Dome, we're wrong, because I thought this was a really heated match. What about you?
Yeah, I thought that this match was, just as you said, like almost everything you hit there. I really loved Kushida's working over the arm
because it leaves everything open for Takahashi's offense with the big wacky dives, without him having to ruin the selling there. I love that after the big sunset bomb, it seemed like it took a long time for Kushida to kind of knock the cobwebs loose to ever get any kind of offense back going. The botch on the big Rana, I don't see how anyone can say that that was a positive to the match. That just looked bad, awkward, and just terrible for both guys involved.
They said it helped because it was this craziness of Takahashi.
I can't buy into it. And my biggest issue with Takahashi, and it's a weird kind of thing to pick because I've heard other people try to say that it's a positive, but my biggest issue with Takahashi is that I think he doesn't fit the Ingobernables at all with the way that he wrestles. Like, everything else about him and his look and his style fits, but he wrestles like the world's biggest tryhard, and Ingobernables is all about kind of having that I don't give a shit attitude. So I just think that it's really interesting that, like, yeah, the stuff that he does like that. It works in the matches, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a terrible thing, but it's just kind of interesting. So
I was more worried the fact that they put another junior in the group.
Right, which is, you know, obviously not great for Bushi unless he gets a tag partner, which could be possible, but...
Oh, I mean, obviously they'll tag up in the tag league. I mean, in the junior belt tag. I mean, the junior tournament.
Yeah, yeah. I just wonder if they'll do that or if they'll get him another tag partner to go for the junior belts, which still would probably be not great.
Or they break up at some point. I mean, one of the two.
Yeah, or someone can leave. But yeah, I thought that it was nice. I mean, Takahashi's looking primarily for knockout blows. Kushida's working on the arm. I love the big fastball punch from Kushida and the he crumples to the mat afterwards. So yeah, I thought that there was a lot of great work in here. I mean, both guys are just amazing. Takahashi even selling the arm was better than you would expect. But again, my thing is just it's so weird. I mean, it doesn't affect the match really, but it just affects like the overall storytelling is that Takahashi just comes across like a guy who wouldn't be in Los Ingobernables in the ring, but he's great here. And yeah, I mean, the wheelbarrow, the super wheelbarrow thing off the top, that just looks so dangerous. I don't know how Kushida didn't land on his head and neck on there. And then yeah, he finishes him off with the power bomb, and yeah, just great focus from both guys. Selling from both guys was on point, and just, you know, high, really delivers with big bombs and dives all the way through. And I give it 4 stars as well. I really enjoyed this match.
Cool. What do you think about Shibata and Goto, which was a really polarizing match on Twitter and stuff?
I get.
Well, hell, I think the whole freaking main event, this one, and I felt the main event was the most polarizing matches on Twitter. But yeah, go on, man.
I get why people can really like this stuff, and there was a lot of epicness to this and a lot of like it felt like a real fight and they're really going at each other hard with, you know, big chops. And I think that Goto does bring out some of the best in Shibata with the way that he can sell and also do the fighting spirit stuff, like the over the top, you know, no selling suplex spots. Can work more solidly with Goto than I really think anybody else, just because of the way that he can kind of keep going. But my problem with it is that, like, this is the Tokyo Dome, and they wrestle every match exactly like this. So it doesn't feel turned up for me for the big show, and, like, there's something really there. And they're friends. Like, you know that they're friends, and so it doesn't – it's just the emotion, and a lot of it rings really hollow to me in that fact that, like, they can't turn it up for the big show because they wrestle like this every time they wrestle each other. You know, there's not really hatred. It's supposed to be mutual respect thing is why they're killing each other, which just doesn't necessarily work for me personally. But, I mean, they're obviously very good together, and the crowd loves it, and there's a lot of excitement and passion, and the finish is super hot with the trading big spots and the GTR, the front GTR, and then the back GTR to finish him off. And Goto winning the belt feels like a big deal, but at the same time, it's like it's the NEVER title, so it doesn't – I don't think this is the right way to rehab him, honestly. So, I mean, for me, I give this 3¾ star, and I really enjoyed it. But the people who I hear who are saying this is the best match on the show, I'm just kind of like – do you only care about, like, the really visceral side of it? And as I said, like, there's no build. There's no real feel of like this is a big match, like match for them. It's like this is just how their matches always are. So it's really tough for me to get like amped up and be like, this is the Tokyo Dome match for them. It's like this is the same match that they have every time. So I don't know. That's where I'm at on this. How about you, Pete?
I was at 3 3/4 also. I mean, there's aspects I liked about this. I liked Shibata after the arm early. There still was too many of the head dropping no sell spots. I can never really get into that. It's just not something that's ingrained in me on how you should work. I see people really do get into it. I would assume after seeing it 10 or 15 times that you'd get desensitized to it and it wouldn't be a big deal anymore, because it's kind of like the old adage, you know, you walk through a village and it's blown up, then you walk to the next village and it's blown up, you walk to the next village and it's blown up, you next to the next village and it's on fire, and then it's blown up. I mean, it loses its impact, and it's just another site. It's not a tragedy anymore. And but some people just get into the style. They tone down the other stuff is wrestling, but we're real wrestling, where they do this. They did it a couple times where Shibata would sit down and let him kick him. But we didn't get a whole lot of that, where sometimes they can just totally take over a match. I like the story of Goto trying to rehab himself, and the crowd bought into it, and I think the match had good heat. So I'll go for it. What they did worked for them, but I totally don't buy this as Goto's big return. I mean, bottom line, he's 0-8 in IWGP matches. So who cares? He's beaten Shibata. He's been the IC belt. So he's winning a belt that he's been below. He's had a belt above this. He's been the tag champion. So I don't see this as like this huge winning the big one type of thing deal that the story that the crowd totally bought into. But I felt New Japan and the announcers changed the true narrative to it. It's not that Goto can't win matches or win titles. It's Goto can't win the big title. That's the story, and that hasn't changed any. So the crowd totally bought all the near falls of Goto and Shibata because of it. But they changed the narrative of what the truth is. So they kind of built an angle on a lie. But if you look closely enough, peel it back, you know this is not a big rehabilitation. And so even the story was kind of shallow. But still, it's an interesting match, 3 3/4. Next up, we got Naito versus Tanahashi. And I loved Naito's slow swagger to the ring, making the ace, and I put that in quotation marks, wait on him. I just like that part. The crowd's hot. I like Naito going after the leg. Tanahashi's selling it big. Tanahashi does some nice revenge spots on Naito's leg. Tanahashi slagged off some of the limb work to do a cool spot here and there, but it didn't really ruin the narrative for me. Both guys are just really great here, and I thought they laid out a really good match. 4.5-star match. This was my favorite match on the show. Tanahashi comes through again on the big show. He's a guy who he's a weird guy for me. I don't think he has great execution. I don't think he has I don't think he does anything great, but I think he does a lot of things well, and that translates into his matches when it comes to selling and the psychology and the storytelling here. But big time coming out party for Naito to beat the guy who a lot of people still consider the ace of New Japan Pro Wrestling. What do you think of the match?
Yeah, I agree with you a lot there. I think that when you talk about Tanahashi and that he doesn't necessarily do anything great, except for I think that there's one thing that he does do great, which is work the crowd. Okay. And I think that's what brings his matches over that top level, is that he's a worker, and he knows what to deliver with what tools he has that'll get the best reactions, and he always does a great job of that. I thought that the Carino's talking point about the wrong knee that Naito was working over was really weird and just an interesting tact to take as a commentator, rather than just helping put over the match. He's talking about the right knee over and over again, and at times even pushing it in a phantom way where I'm kind of like, I feel like you're just really, you know, stretching to fit this story in there that's not really making a lot of sense. But
maybe he was pushing it as him and Naito having their feud?
Possibly. I mean, that could be it, but it's just a really interesting, weird thing for him to be doing there. But yeah, I mean, Naito selling the knee was great throughout, and then the sling blade on the apron I just thought was insane, and the high fly flow to the floor ends up with both guys just impressively selling as Tanahashi's barely starting to stand up and Naito hasn't moved, and the ref is already at the 10 count, which I just thought was great. The crowd was super hot from the start of the match, and they were all over Tanahashi for the gut punch, which I thought was really interesting. And then, yeah, towards the end, I think the big thing that can kind of be the iconic standout part of this is they're both just going back and forth, really just stomping on each other's knees as they're standing there. And it's like, it wasn't even a kick. Like, they weren't really kicking each other. They were like legitimately stepping up and over and downwardly stomping right on the guy's knee, on the top of their knee, into the, just kind of grinding their whole shin and everything into the mat with these big stomps back and forth.
Really hate filled. You're right. Those spots were really hate filled.
Yeah, and it was just – that was probably the big transcendent spot of the match. Naito built up that cross knee lock that he used throughout the G1, and he really, you know, kind of put himself over as a leg assassin throughout the G1. So, again, really good here as it's coming back to that in the big match with Tanahashi. But, yeah, I mean, after last year with Okada getting the big win over Tanahashi, being that kind of now he can be considered 100% the ace, and then you turn around and have Naito do it the next year, it does feel like a coronation for him as well, even if it is for the IC title. But it does bring back, you know, reminiscence of Naito getting shirked to the second main event, or the undercard main event that year when he won the G1, and he didn't get to be in the main event for his title shot. And, you know, Tanahashi did in the IC title match. Well, now he turns around and they're in the second spot again, and he's the IC champion now, and he takes it to Tanahashi here and really kind of cements himself in his spot. I thought that was great. And yeah, I just thought good stuff. I gave it 4.25. And I guess, just spoiler alert, it was not my match of the night.
You know, not a spoiler. I think everyone knows.
Yes.
Would you like to see? Because, like, I've heard complaints, and I mean, I think it's a solid complaint where they he won with his finisher, which is, you know, a big time normal. That's normalcy in New Japan. Would you like to see maybe him maybe develop a different finisher for this match and go over like some form of leg lock? Would have given his character a different wrinkle, and showing he's adaptable for the big dome show.
Well, that cross knee lock that he did get victories with and used really effectively throughout the G1 could have probably used a legitimization here with getting the victory over Tanahashi. I think if he had beat Tanahashi with that cross knee lock at the dome for the IC title, I think that hold is now instantly a killer. And yeah, People will buy it as a finish for every match for the rest of time. So, I mean, yeah, that would have been a big deal. But it is kind of that New Japan turning into, you know, early 90s WWE thing where it's like everybody's got to hit their finish, because if you don't win with your finish, then what was the point of the match, kind of thing. So I definitely get the complaint, but I also understand why it went that way. Yeah, I think that they did miss the boat, and I hadn't really thought of it, but you saying that, I definitely agree. I think that they should have done that. They should have had him go over with some kind of leg lock submission hold here.
After the main event, do you trump Dave Meltzer's trending Twitter 6 stars?
Oh, yeah. 7 stars. No. I mean, what am I going to say, right? I gave it 5 stars. I thought that this match was amazing. I think that anyone who's trying to argue that the first 10 minutes of this match were dead is diluting themselves. The first 10 minutes of this match, the crowd was hot. When the bell rings, the crowd is hot, just for the fact that the match is starting. They're buying everything. They're into everything. Everything is super dynamic. The trading back and forth. There's even small wrinkles. Something that I noticed that probably people don't pick up is Tanahashi usually does a forward roll into the Kryptonite Crunch Neckbreaker. Here he goes for it, but Kenny catches him, and that's where he bridges up into the powerbomb, or he bridges up to set up the like powerbomb position from there. And like even that was like a little thing that I think, you know, most people don't see that because it's just kind of a normal trading pins back and forth spot, but it was actually kind of a counter to a regular move kind of situation here. But yeah, I just thought Kenny was amazing from the go, and Okada was game and apt the whole way through. I mean, Okada's overness is what brings it in here. The storytelling of the match, basically, Kenny spends the whole time on the neck and the spine. Even what they're calling kidney shots or forearms to the kind of the back area and the spine. And his big finish, obviously, is a driver that compresses the neck and spine. The whole way through, that's what he's looking for, and he never gets it, which I love that also as a something I've been putting over all year, if you've been listening to this show, is finding unique ways to get your move countered instead of just having your move get kicked out. Kenny never gets his move here, which he was looking for the whole way through. I just thought, you know, keeping it pretty much 100% clean with the Young Bucks never getting involved, just serving as moral support the whole way through, was important as well to making this match feel epic and like a big deal. And yeah, I just think the finish coming out with Okada just laying Rainmaker after Rainmaker to finally put him down was kind of amazing. And yeah, I just thought that Kenny was phenomenal here. I mean, you watch this thing and it's 40 some odd minutes long and it breezes by. I don't think that there's an argument to say that Kenny was the 100% the show here, though. I think Okada was also really good and probably the best that Okada's looked in a while. I mean, he was there game for every spot. His connection with the crowd is a big deal. His selling was amazing with the big shots to the neck and the back of the head. And taking that gigantic dragon suplex that just appeared like it had to have killed him.
Okay, speaking of that, that was one of my complaints about the match. How can you possibly do that move and not finish a match with that?
I get where you're coming from.
To me, it's like, if you're not going to use that move as if your finisher, as the finish, then don't even do the move. Do a superplex. Do whatever. I thought that was like a way over the top exposing and a risk factor that you could honestly significantly you could have broken both the guys' necks on that spot.
I see that and I get the complaint, but I mean the argument is where is a bigger place to do a move like that? You're at the main event of the Tokyo Dome.
Right. But again,
what's the biggest match of his career?
Kenny Omega? That should have finished him. I mean that should have been a finisher. That should not have been a transition move. That we see Okada go on offense about a minute later. That like me taking a gunshot to the stomach and then going and making my way to the dinner table and eating a McRib.
I can see where you're coming from on that, 100%. But I think that the point was that Okada, you know, came back. I mean, he ends up winning it. And I think the idea is, yes, it's, I mean, the big idea of it is it's a really awesome, insane spot to go over the top at the Tokyo Dome to really do something nuts, right? And I also get where you're coming from, that that's not something that you should do if it's not going to be the finish because it's just an unbelievable random spot. But it's also being put into the context that Okada is the ace now, and so he's got that over-the-top fighting spirit. He can take anything, and he's not going to give up, and he's going to keep the title thing. Which is a big deal, you know? And I just think there's moments in here where obviously the crowd gets super behind Kenny and him losing. I think a lot of people think like, yeah, maybe he should have won and maybe even a spot like that should have definitely been the finish. But I think that just the way that the culture works in Japanese wrestling, for the most part, the idea of him not being able to get the job done here and then coming back and valiantly fighting back to eventually, you know, win the title as a babyface, I think will get him over a lot bigger than it would have just winning the belt here. So I can understand where you're coming from on that suplex, the dragon suplex off the top, but I mean, in the moment, that has to be one of the wildest things I've ever seen, and that does play into the argument that you're even saying, that it's too wild to believe that someone would actually kick out of it. But I mean, I can't 100% defend that, but in the moment, in the match, to me, I bought into it, I guess, because of the storytelling.
I totally buy into it in the moment type of stuff, but yeah, when I just took back, it's like, that was like, to me, like a deal breaker to me and stuff, but go on.
Right, no, and I can get you, but I think the point is that you're solidifying Okada even further as the ace and the guy who wins at the Dome, you know, and the guy who has that extra, like, extra human ability in the big time match here now, because he was able to finally put away Tanahashi, and he is the guy. And one of the problems with being one of the deals with being the guy is that the guy wins at the big show. And so I guess, yeah, what do you say? Cut that move from the match, but I mean, fuck, that move is just, it was just something else. So, I mean, that's kind of it for me. I mean, I'm seeing arguments against the match, and for me, I just think that a lot of people, I don't know. I mean, I think some people came into it not wanting to enjoy it as much as they could let themselves. I think some people are recalling things differently than how it actually was, because I've watched this match like 3 or 4 times now, and the stuff about the first 10 minutes being boring, I just don't see it at all. And that's like the biggest attack that I've seen on the match otherwise. And maybe there were some zany spots, but it's really hard for me to 100% shit on super zany spots. I know I've said stuff like you should be, you know, using stuff as a finish in general for other situations, but I mean, these guys want to take these risks. This is kind of the only situation where I'm not going to shit on you. If you're taking these big risks in front of 25 to 30 people, then I'm going to say, hey, save it. But I mean, this is the big Tokyo Dome match, so you know what? Go for it. Go as big as you can.
All right. Now, at the beginning, I don't have any time. I have no problem with them going slow at the beginning. I liked how how it started and how it escalated, so I had no problem with that. I would have, I think I saw Parv mention this, and I agree with him. I would have liked to see some of the earlier stuff just use basic stuff, like a basic slam, this or that. I thought they went a little wacky a little too quickly at times. I did like the pacing early, because the first big move that they hit was Okada hitting that, you know, that DDT off the ring barrier. And he got over big, and I thought of it, a lot of it was because I thought they built to it well with the slow pacing, and then made that impact matter. But then they kind of erased everything, because then they went balls to the wall later in the match. So, to me, the early part of the match easily could have been cut off, because the whole point of doing that pacing is to lead to big spots standing out, and they just ran the gauntlet of so many big spots that they didn't really need that pacing. They could have cut 10 or 15 minutes and just gone into it and just called it what it was, and maybe only spent a few minutes. They could have gone 5 minutes instead of 15 to hit that Okada spot, and I think it would have made the match tighter, because the whole point of going where they were going was for pacing issues and to make Matt Moose stand out. But in the grand scheme of things, when there was like 50, or I mean, that's an exaggeration, but 15 or 20 big impact moves, you didn't really need the pacing to lead to them, because then eventually at the end of the match, they really didn't matter, because they kind of got erased because they were going through them so much, except for moves like a dragon suplex out the top really stood out, because that's insane. I thought Omega was amazing, bumping and doing everything he can. I thought that table breaking spot was probably the best table breaking spot I've ever seen. I'm not a big fan of bringing tables into the match, but it worked here, so I had no problem then. I thought it was nasty, the Okada taking that bump where Kenny just stomps onto the table on him blindly. That takes a real man, because you can't protect yourself. I thought Okada could have shown a little bit more fire in the match. I felt at times Gato was showing more fire on the outside, and it helped with his beating on the mat. I think I saw Chad mention this. It helped him help the Heat get up, but it didn't. But it was Okada and Omega who got the. I think Gato helped them get the Heat, but bottom line, it was those are the guys who had them. But those two guys kept it. I felt there was a little paint by the numbers early, like it was Okada again going after the neck and did his basic. That's the whole entire thing where I think a lot of the people are complaining about the early part is it was a basic Okada opening where he likes to stretch it out. We were seeing you do some basic work on the neck and leading to that big spot, but they didn't really need it because of everything they're doing, which they got over the neck work anyway. They didn't have to start it out so slow. Overall, I give it 4.25. I thought it was a hell of a match, and again, a strong main event. But I just can't go high, like 5 stars on it. I just thought it had too many psychological flaws. But the physicality of what Omega did, I thought it was amazing. And I'm not a huge Omega guy. I've come around on him. But it had a couple glitches that kept it out of an all-time classic match for me. Overall, I mean, people right now are calling this a show of the year. I have no problem at this point in time calling it a show of the year. I think I got to see how the rest of the year transpires. Do I see this winning show of the year for me? No. Because I'm expecting a better show coming down the pike. But I thought the last 4 matches delivered. I thought we had a solid undercard. It wasn't a great undercard by any stretch of the imagination. It was a competent undercard. But an easy thumbs up show. Where do you stand on this?
It's January 4th, so yeah, no, show yeah. of the year conversation is tough.
Yeah, right off the bat when there's nothing to compare it to.
But with those 4 matches in a row being as good as they are, I think it's going to be tough for anything to overtake it, really, for a while. But the problem is, by the end of the year, a good amount of people will have forgotten. So yeah. I don't necessarily know how it'll do next year when it comes to voting time for show of the year. Overall, though, it's a definite thumbs-up show. As we talked about, I think that the undercard was solid and dipped in a couple places, but realistically not in any way that was, like, super offensive, unless you're someone who holds Kota Ibushi to a really high standard. I could definitely see being offended by that match just because you expect so much more from him.
Yeah.
But overall, everything else really delivered really well. I didn't even mention him, but you did. Adam Page, Hangman Page, did really well in his match here. For a guy debuting on the Tokyo Dome, I thought he looked good. A guy who could definitely have a bright future in New Japan if they keep pushing on him. So there was almost kind of everything on this show that you want. Obviously, you kind of got to watch this main event just for all of the hullabaloo that's around it, whether you believe it or not. It's an important match for the history of wrestling now. Dave Meltzer gave it 6 stars, and that's going to mean something pretty much forever, which is kind of cool for a guy like Kenny Omega, who, I mean, for me, I really enjoyed the match. I thought that there was good enough storytelling, not just good enough, but I thought that there was great storytelling with callbacks to the history that, you know, Okada and Omega have had together. I thought that the work was done really well, and the focus was done really well from both guys. Selling everything. So it's like, I think it's something to check out, but even more, what kind of got me was the next day listening to Dave Meltzer talk about Kenny Omega, after being a fan of his for over 10 years, finally kind of having that validation of the top journalist in wrestling openly saying just how good Kenny Omega is kind of really got to me in an emotional way. 'Cause I've been on this journey with him, kind of doing everything his way and not kind of kowtowing to what they tell him or what wrestling tells him should be. So, I mean, am I overly invested in Kenny Omega in some ways? Yes, but there's a lot of other people who got on the Kenny Omega bandwagon within the past year who are also calling this an all-time classic match. So I think it's a big deal no matter what point in the Kenny Omega story you've kind of jumped on. It was an important match and an important show and definitely a thumbs-up show all around. I'd say watch it. It's long. It's really long, but I don't think that you can very seriously at the end of the year talk about show of the year, match of the year, any of that stuff if you didn't watch this show. I think I would take that to the end of the year no matter what. I'll say your list can't be looked at as 100% serious if you didn't watch Wrestle Kingdom.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a great show. I have no problems with it. I thought everyone worked their asses off. Production I thought was really cool. Definitely check it out, you know. Definitely, it's interesting to see so many different takes on a main event. And this is I think this show caused more spirited debates on Twitter than normal. It really brought out a lot of feelings. And like you said, you've been on this journey with Kenny Omega, and I think wrestling should be personal. So it's good to get behind a guy and the most important thing is he delivered for you, and that's all that really matters in the grand scheme of things, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, man, that's it, man. Anything you got to plug?
We talked about it earlier, but the We'll Do It Live podcast over here, it's on the same feed that you're listening to this on. So if you found this, you know how to find that. Check it out. Me, Johnny P, and Jeremy Bryant, who is not only a contributor to PWP, but he is the newly minted CWF Mid-Atlantic reviewer for The Torch. So you don't get much higher than that when it comes to being an authority on the CWF Mid-Atlantic, right? So, because, you know, The Observer doesn't cover it. If you're going to hear someone talk about CWF Mid-Atlantic, what it's like live, I think that the bona fides are there with this group of guys. You got a guy who experienced ECW in its heyday and ROH in its heyday, comparing CWF Mid-Atlantic to those two promotions and their live feel. You got the guy who's been going for so long and is seen as the man when it comes to reviewing CWF Mid-Atlantic, talking about it. And then you got me, some schlub who started covering it with you a couple months back, but enjoyed the match.
Yeah, and the company's really embraced us and treated us really well on Twitter and stuff,
which we appreciate so much. But what we really appreciate is the product that they put out more than anything.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's the biggest thing to check out right now, other than, you know, my normal podcast, Lucha Undead. I do that every week with my buddy Adrian. Coming out when you're listening to this should be my interview with QT Moody. He's not just the co-host now. He's actually the guest. Get into some interesting stuff with his life and his background. And as always, if you want to find anything that I'm doing, you can just follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead.
Awesome, man. Follow me on Twitter at Titans O Wrestling. Peace out and have a great week.
I'll be at the reception desk, sketching on flesh my perceptions of death.